And it is a great pleasure to welcome back to the program for a second visit Captain Jim Lovell, U.S. Navy retired, who was, of course, the commander of Apollo 13. That wasn't his first venture into space. It was his fourth.
That's right, Milt, my fourth time. I got to be an old codger by that time.
Yeah. First there was Gemini 7, then Gemini 12, and then Apollo 8, which was the first full circumnavigation of the moon, as I remember.
That's right. It was December of 1968. We were the first three people to see the far side of the moon and blazed the trail for future flights going to the moon.
What did you see down there on the far side? Who was hiding down there?
Actually, it's a little bit more rugged than the front side because the front side has much larger round, what we call them mares or seas. There are probably large craters and like a molten lava. But on the far side, it is a little bit more rugged and rocky.
What are you going to be doing at 1:13 p.m. tomorrow?
That's a good question. I think I will actually probably be in my office thinking about 30 years ago of what I was doing then.
Because that will be the exact 30-year anniversary to the minute of the takeoff of Apollo 13.
That's right. April 11th, 1970 at 1313 Central Standard Time is when we took off.
And this was to be your first moon landing. You had been around the moon, seen the far side of the moon, but now you were going to be the third team to land on the moon.
And this note was going to be the highlight of my career. I couldn't think of anything I could do other than land on the moon and then probably go into NASA management or something like that.
I'll give you another time worth remembering, if I can find it quickly. Yes. What were you doing at 55 hours, 46 minutes after the flight took off?
Well, we were some 200,000 miles from Earth, and I was just sliding my way from the lunar module into the command module through the tunnel when something disastrous occurred.
You said at that moment, you said a few minutes before that, as you were winding down a TV broadcast that you had been doing, all three of you, you said, these are your words, this is the crew of Apollo 13 wishing everybody there a nice evening, and we're just about ready to close out our inspection of Aquarius, that's the lunar module, and get back for a pleasant evening in Odyssey, the command module. Good night.
Good night. Yes, I almost like a Walter Cronkite there.
Six minutes later,
a big bang. And you know that no one was really watching that TV program. None of the networks carried it. I think that only it was being shown at down there in Houston at the center.
It was routine. You were the third team to land on the moon, not the first.
By that time, the flights to the moon were beginning to be quite routine, and everybody was complacent.
We've got some sound clips, and I don't know that we can reproduce the bang, but we can get a sense of the crisis as it came upon you very suddenly. This is from real life, though it's a montage. It compresses into just a minute or so many of the crucial moments up to the crisis.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit and we have liftoff at 2:13. Senate is clear of the tower.
This is the crew of Apollo 13. Wishing everybody there a nice evening, and we're just about ready to close out our inspection of Aquarius and get back for a pleasant evening in Odyssey. Good night.
13, we've got one more item for you when you get a chance. We'd like it to stir up your cryo tank.
Stand by.
Hey,
we've
had a problem here.
Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Famous words. Houston, we have a problem.
That's getting to be part of the public domain, I guess. An old cliche, Houston, we've had a problem. Actually, if you listen to that carefully, Swikert was the first person to say that Houston, we've had a problem. And but they're down at the control center. They're also sort of closing up shop, you know, changing shifts.
They say again.
Because they weren't even listening. So they said, say again, please. And then I came up and said, Houston, we've had a problem. We've had something like an undervolt or something like that.
You had just heard a big bang.
Yes.
You didn't yet know what it was.
Oh, no, we had, not only we heard a big bang, but we had jets were firing indiscriminately. There was noise. Warning lights were starting to come on. Caught us completely by surprise. And this is the time we were just about winding ourselves down for a pleasant evening and of not doing anything but going to sleep.
What do you remember of how you felt, what you privately thought, in the succeeding 10 or 15 minutes at the height of the danger?
At the height of the danger, before we knew any ways that we could, you know, save ourselves, there are several things that people go through, and I've often been told this, but I guess it's true. You know, one thought to me is, why now? Why me? Why didn't this happen on 12 or wait till 14 or something like that, you know? But then, of course, the first thing we thought about was that we were hit by a meteor. And if a spacecraft wall had been punctured, we'd lose all our atmosphere and we'd, you know, soon be dead. So we tried to close the hatch secured our from the lunar module, and thinking the lunar module was hit so we could escape from the air going out of there. But it turned out that we couldn't close the hatch for some reason. And by that time, we realized that had a hole been made, we'd have been dead.
Did you have a sense this is the end?
Not really. It's a case of we were still breathing, and we still had some time, we thought. And so we decided to say, well, you know, let's find out what happened. People often ask, you know, do we panic? Well, we could have bounced off the walls for 10 minutes, but we'd be right back where we started from. So we decided, let's see what we could do to get ourselves out of this mess.
And it was a while before you were able to figure out that what had happened was that one of the oxygen tanks on the service module, isn't that right?
That's correct.
Had simply blown up.
Yes, we knew that we had an explosion, and when we saw the oxygen escaping from the rear end of the spacecraft, and we saw on the indicators, the quantity gauges, that we lost one tank completely and we're losing the second tank, we knew that we were in deep trouble.
What would the nature of the trouble have been? You lose the oxygen and in one tank, and the oxygen is escaping from a second tank, I believe. What's the consequence in terms of all the other systems that have to be maintained?
Well, first of all, we needed oxygen to breathe and to pressurize the spacecraft, and it was also used to produce electricity. The first thing that really occurred at the explosion, two of the fuel cells went off the line, which meant we lost them, we couldn't get them back. But oxygen was used to produce electricity in the third fuel cell, so that was really the critical time, because we normally could have made it back home on one fuel cell, but when we were going to lose the third fuel cell, we knew that we were in deep trouble, and also we used oxygen to control and gimbal our rocket engine, so we'd lost the entire propulsion system.
So of all the necessary systems for life maintenance and for maintenance not only of your own biological lives, but maintenance of the craft so it could be controlled and so it could be brought back to Earth, you got to worry about oxygen, about power, about water, and about the leakage of carbon dioxide.
Well, that's true. In the first thing, though, on the command module, we were losing everything. We knew the command module was dying. Fortunately, we did have the lunar module. But some of the...
We've got here a three-stage rocket, a three-stage vehicle at that moment. Isn't that right?
Well, no, the booster was three stages, but we had long since gotten rid of the booster.
Yeah.
We had, really, what we had a lunar module, we had a command service module, which might be the two stages. The service module is where we had the explosion.
Yeah, but it can be detached from the command module.
Yes, but we didn't know when to do that. In fact, we didn't do it until just before we hit the atmosphere on the way home.
Yeah.
But it was the lunar module that gave us the life support to get home, because the command module was dying.
The first thing you do, you and your two colleagues, is you dash into the lunar module, the landing
That's the landing
craft, where you can maintain yourselves.
Well, yes, we are forced in there because we were losing all the oxygen on the command module.
Mm-hmm.
So we went into the lunar module, fired up its systems. Now, you have to realize at the time the explosion occurred, we were some 200,000 miles from Earth. We were 90 hours from Earth because we had to go around the moon to get back home again.
Just take the craft and turn it and do a sharp 180-degree turn and head back home.
Well, there was a procedure for doing that. He said that we had to use the command module's propulsion system, and it had died because we didn't have electrical power to operate it.
So you had to go around the moon and let the moon give you the gravitational push back to
Earth. That's right. It swung us back towards the Earth. But the lunar module was only designed to last for 45 hours, not 90 hours.
And you were facing 90.
And it was only designed to support two people, and there were three people on board. I kept counting the crew all the time, thinking I was wrong. So it was that was the real challenge, was how to stretch a 45-hour vehicle into 90 hours and how to stretch a vehicle for two people into three.
Well, we're going to talk about those problems, and we're going to talk about the wonderful solutions that you worked out and the great coolness and clarity of mind with which you and your colleagues down at the base at Houston, who were assisting you all the way. And we're also going to hear some clips from the movie in which you are played by Tom Hanks.
Sure.
And I know you were a consultant on the film, so we'll listen to those and get a sense of, and I'll ask you after each one, how accurate is it and what it represents.
Okay.
We return directly to Jim Lovell and shortly to Tom Hanks and others from the film of Apollo 13, but first we pause for these words.
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. Now, here's Milton Rosenberg.
And we return to Jim Lovell, who, together with Jeffrey Kluger, is the author of Apollo 13. That is, in fact, an updated edition of the book that appeared some 5 years ago as Lost Moon, but it's got a new preface.
That's right. It's got a new foreword to it. It's a 30th anniversary edition to it, new dust cover, the whole thing, and... it's got a very good lead in indicating what's happened since that time, you know, to the space program in
yes.
general.
And we need to talk about what's happened, or rather what's not happened
yes,
to the space
what's
program
not happened, is right.
in succeeding years. But for now, let's go to the film. July 95, this film is released. Tom Hanks is you.
That's right.
Were you satisfied with Hanks as you?
Oh, yes. I often kid Tom, because when Howard first said, "Who do you want to play your part?" I wasn't that knowledgeable about actors or actresses, but I happened to see Dances with Wolves about 8 months before, and I said, mm-hmm. "Well, how about Kevin Costner?" And he was busy with Waterworld, but Hanks did a great job. Of course, he's his own person, but he's a space enthusiast. He's a closet astronaut, and he, you know, loved every bit of what he was doing.
Now, here are some clips from the film, and the first one, in fact, replays the moment we've already played in real life. This is where the trouble hits. And Hanks is the one who says, "Houston, we've got a problem." Here it is.
"Hey, we've got a problem here."
"What did you do?"
"Nothing. I stirred the tanks."
"Whoa. Hey.
This is Houston. Say again, please."
"Houston, we have a problem. We have a main bus B undervolt. We've got a lot of thruster
Let's
activity here, Houston.
Now.
It just went offline. Oh, there's another master alarm, Houston."
"I'm checking a quad."
"Christ, there's no refresh valve.
Maybe it's in quad C.
We've got a computer restart.
I'm trying to reconfigure the RCS.
We've got a pit light.
When these things fire, doesn't make any sense.
We've got multiple caution and warning, Houston. We've got a reset and restart."
"All right, I'm going to SPS."
"Jesus. Like, the heart rates are skyrocketing.
Econ, what's your data telling you?"
O2 tank 2 not reading at all. Tank 1 is at 725 PSI and falling. Fuel cells 1 and 3 are, oh boy, what's going on here? Flight, let me get back to you.
Flight GNC?
Flight, they're all over the place. They keep going close to gimbal lock."
I keep losing radio signal. Flight, their antenna must be flipped.
22, do it manually.
One at a time, people. One at a time. One at a time. Ecom, is this an instrumentation problem, or are we looking at real power loss here?"
It's reading a quadruple failure. That can't happen. It's got to be instrumentation."
"Let's get that hatch button. The limb might have been hit by a meteor."
"Yep.
The tunnel's really torquey with all this movement.
Houston, we got a pretty large bang there associated with a master alarm. Houston's main bus A.
A undervolt.
Houston, we have a main bus A undervolt now, too. It's reading 25 and a half. Main bus B is reading zip right now. We got a wicked shimmy up here."
"Look on GNC, these guys are talking about bangs and shimmies up there. It doesn't sound like instrumentation to me."
"You are breaking up, 13.
You get this hatch to seal.
Just going. We've been hit by a meteor. We'd be dead by now. I'm going to try to get us out of this lurch."
"Houston, you're in the mud. Did you say switch to Omni Bravo?" "Roger, and the signal strength on the high gate.
Fighting me. What's the story here, Jack? We keep putting with gimbal lock."
"Odyssey, we need a confirmation. What system do you have now?"
"Okay, Jim. SMRCS, Helium 1. A, and
Charlie.
Barbacole.
Houston, I'm switching over Quad C to Main A."
"Roger that, 13.
Okay, Houston. Fuel cell 1. Fuel cell 3. We got a main bus B undervolt. Cryo pressure. Two compressor. AC bus 1. AC bus 2. Command module computer.
And O2 flow high. I don't know.
Maybe this is a caution and warning."
"Houston? We are venting something out into space."
"I can see it
outside of window one right now. Definitely a gas of some sort.
It's got to be the oxygen.
Scares me, Milt.
It scares you as you hear it, doesn't it?
Actually, that sequence in the movie was quite accurate. You know, the one thing where we try to put the hatch in there to prevent, in case the lunar module got hit, we didn't want to lose all our oxygen in the command module. Well, and then we couldn't lock the hatch, so we just stored it, you know, and they reproduced it directly.
Everything went awry as quickly as that? Is that sort of real in the time sequence?
Yes, it was quite and the thing is, it really threw the people in the control center because, you know, we have redundancy. We have three fuel cells, two oxygen tanks, and everything like that. And they thought at first that it was that all these false indications or the indications they're seeing on their instruments were false due to maybe some interruption of the communication by a solar flare or something like that. They couldn't believe that all this was happening at the same time on the vehicle.
From that moment, it seems almost impossible that you're going to make it and you're going to get down. Yet you did. That depends upon the coolness of mind, the clarity of mind, and the great technical skill, I suppose, of all the people involved.
Yeah, so it's a great example of teamwork. When all these things happen at one time, and fortunately we still had enough oxygen to keep breathing, we could go in the lunar module, but we had no clue of how to get home. And so we had to work out all those solutions as we progressed. And for the 4 days of the way home, there was one crisis after another. But it was a motivation. It was the initiative of the ground crew, headed up by Gene Kranz, of course, that got us home safely.
What's the problem with the carbon dioxide that you generate just by breathing?
Well, one of the things we had in the lunar module, we had canisters, lithium hydroxide canisters, that would remove the carbon dioxide that is produced by our own exhalation. But there are only enough canisters to support two guys for 2 days.
And you got to put three guys in the lunar landing module
for 4 days.
For 4 days.
That's right. And so the partial pressure of carbon dioxide kept growing, and it could be poisonous if it gets too much carbon dioxide. So what the ground had to do was to try to figure out how to use the useless square canisters that were in the command module, which, of course, we couldn't use in system, to work into the lunar module system, which used round canisters. And you can't put a square canister in a round hole. So we had to use tape, plastic, and cardboard to what we call jury-rig a square canister to work in the lunar module. That was really a classic case of
innovation. Worked out the design for you down at Houston and conveyed it to you and told you how to build it.
That's right. They worked out the design, tested the thing, and then they, step by step, they said, you know, take an arm length's worth of tape, duct tape, fortunately we had it, you know, take a piece of cardboard from a flight manual and get a piece of plastic from one of the suit packages. And so we started to work on this jury rig.
Of course, sitting in the lunar module for most of the rest of the ride, you also had to keep... Well, another problem was water. You need water to survive, but you had very little water left.
Well, that's true. We needed water not only to drink, but also to cool all of our systems. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of went on a ration, which maybe it was too strict at the time because we really became dehydrated.
And you had some left when you landed.
We did, and I also lost 14 pounds on a six-day journey.
Mm-hmm. What was your ration, your water ration?
Well, we just drank as little as possible, but we had a leak in one of our little water guns, and it started to form up on the floor. And in fact, it got Jack Swigert's foot all wet. He didn't have any boots on at the time.
Now, as you go through all this time, you're still heading towards the moon, and you've got to work out a plan for how to get back to Earth. Do you work out the plan problem by problem, or is there a master plan that's developed between you and Houston within the first day?
There was a problem by problem to begin with. Then they decided on a master plan because they had to figure out, should we get them home fast? Should we get them home slow?
Mm-hmm.
The first thing they did was to get us on what we called the free return course again, which meant that when we went around the moon, we'd hopefully intercept the Earth in some manner rather than be a permanent monument to the space program, you know, in a large orbit around the Earth going out 240,000 miles towards the moon.
Here's another clip from the film. It ends with a wonderful line. I assume this is from real life also. This is when Mission Control realizes that the current predictions leave the crew 45 hours short of Earth, and something radical has to be done.
So you're telling me you can only give our guys 45 hours? That brings them to about there.
Gentlemen, that's not acceptable.
Gene, we've got to talk about power here. Whoa, guys, power is everything.
Power is everything. Mm-hmm. Without it, they don't talk to us. They don't correct their trajectory. They don't turn the heat shield around. We got to turn everything off. Now. They're not going to make it to reentry.
What do you mean, everything?
With everything on, the LEM draws 60 amps. At that rate, in 16 hours, the batteries are dead, not 45. And so's the crew. We got to get them down to 12 amps.
How many? You can't run a vacuum cleaner on 12 amps, John.
We have to turn off the radars, cabin heater, instrument displays, the guidance computer, the whole smack.
Whoa, guidance computer? What if they need to do another burn? Gene, they won't even know which way they're pointing.
The more time we talk down here, the more juice they waste up there. I've been looking at the data for the past hour.
That's the deal?
That's the deal.
Okay, John. The minute we finish the burn, we'll power down the limb.
All right.
Now, in the meantime, we're going to have a frozen command module up there. In a couple days, we're going to have to power it up using nothing but the reentry batteries.
We've been tried before.
Hell, we've never even simulated it before, Gene.
Well, we're going to have to figure it out. I want people in our simulators working reentry scenarios. I want you guys to find every engineer who designed every switch, every circuit, every transistor, and every light bulb that's up there. Then I want you to talk to the guy in the assembly line who actually built the thing. Find out how to squeeze every amp out of both of these goddamn machines. I want this mark all the way back to Earth with time to spare. We never lost an American in space. We're sure as hell not going to lose one on my watch. Failure is not an option.
Now, all of that is down at command at Houston.
That's at the control center in Houston.
Who's the main character there?
Gene Kranz, played by Ed Harris in the movie, and that's who you heard on the clip. But Gene Kranz got a tiger team together from all of his controllers to figure out what were the solutions. And when he said, okay, John, that was John Aaron who figured out a lot of the how to save a lot of the electrical power so that we could fire back up the command module because we had to use it to get back through the atmosphere. Very good example of how crisis management was taken effect here in this particular problem.
They use the story of Apollo 13, and maybe even the film these days, in various corporate settings where they're doing seminars on crisis management. So I've been informed.
That's true, Milt. Now, they do that quite a bit, and both Gene and I have given a lot of seminars. Sometimes we do them together to companies showing the steps that we took to solve the problems of Apollo 13.
Well, now, what can you derive from the Apollo 13 experience that applies, say, to a crisis in a corporation?
Well, first of all, is that you always have to expect the unexpected. When I got in to fly the vehicle or maneuver it from the lunar module rather than the normal command module, I didn't realize that I had a 60,000-pound dead mass hanging on the lunar module. It was never designed to fly that way. So the one thing is, you know, always expect the unexpected. Look ahead for crisis or look behind you. Somebody might be catching up to you with a new product or a better way of marketing it or something like that. And this teamwork concept is very, very important. More brains are better, you know, than just a single brain. So work together.
The first principle sounds rather like the old Murphy's Law. If anything can go wrong, it will.
That's exactly right.
And so you better be aware of all the things that might go wrong.
That's right. You have to think about, hey, what happens? What do I do if this happens? Fortunately, the crew was well-versed in malfunction procedures. And Swikert, by the way, being a replacement, actually wrote the malfunction procedures for the command module. So if we had to get a replacement at the last moment, he was the best guy to put on board.
He was replaced at the last moment because the man who was supposed to go was exposed to German measles or something.
That's exactly right. In fact, the whole crew was exposed to the measles. Hayes and I, you know, being married, having kids that had the measles, and we had the measles. We were immune to the disease, but Manley was a bachelor, never had the measles. And the doctors thought sure that he was going to get them about the time he was by himself orbiting the moon waiting for us to come up.
Mm-hmm. So that was sort of a bit of adventitious luck also, wasn't it?
That's true. It was.
If he hadn't been replaced by Swigert, then...
Well, Swigert was very competent to begin with. And, of course, the movie, that was a little artistic license on part of the movie. The movie depicts that, you know, he had to earn his wings every day, but he was well-qualified from the beginning.
We pause once again. This isn't a crisis exactly, but every so often I have to remind myself that we've got commercials to take care of. We are talking with Jim Lovell, and and I should make utterly clear that the book of a few years ago, Lost Moon, has been updated. An excellent and important preface has been written. It has been retitled as well, Apollo 13. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Also, it has a series of pictures in it that are all...
Some new pictures. That
available for the first
time.
We're
out of the first book.
Yeah. Including the families down on the ground.
That's right, yes.
And your wife looks composed and lovely, but under a certain strain, I would say.
A tremendous strain. Doesn't quite show it there in the picture, but she was hurting.
We will be directly back to Jim Lovell as we continue the flight of Apollo 13 after these words.
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. This is Milton Rosenberg.
And so there you are, Jim Lovell, Commander, and Hayes and Swigert, your two fellow astronauts. The immediate surprise of the explosion and all the quick adjustment that will be done after that is over, and you're still heading towards the moon. You're heading away from Earth. You may have a few moments when you're not actually plugging holes and making emergency and conducting emergency operations. Do you guys talk to one another about your situation?
That's exactly right. We looked out the window, and of course the moon is only about 25,000 miles away now. It's filling up the entire lunar module window, and I looked over at Fred Hayes, and he was making some computations on the back of an old envelope, and he said, you know, Jim, I don't have to tell you this, but in the condition we're in right now, we'll never get home. You know, the batteries are going to die before we get home. Even water is critical. He said, we might have enough oxygen because we have it in those backpacks back there in the lunar module that we're going to use on the lunar surface, and we can tap into those, but, you know, that's even, you know, questionable. And I said, you're right, Fredo. The way we are right now, you know, we'll never get home. And meanwhile, the down on the ground, they also realize the same thing, and they're trying to figure out how to speed up our return home.
But for a while, you and Hayes, and I presume Swigert, all agreed this is probably the end. We're not going to get home. Were you morose? Were you depressed? Were you trying to console each other? Or were you just keeping cool?
Well, I guess we have to say we were keeping cool because we didn't have the feeling that there wasn't a solution to our problem so far. We knew that the mission control was trying to work on how to speed up our return. We had the lunar module engine that worked fine for the first time to get us back on a what we call a free return course, and we were expecting them to come up with some answers, before we got around the back side of the moon, the far side, because we had, of course, lost communication with them on the far side of the moon.
So, meanwhile, back in Houston, they're working desperately on the plan. What did they come up with?
Well, here's where that old teamwork and that motivation really came into being. They said, okay, let's use that lunar module engine a second time. When the moon swings them around, aims them back towards the Earth, we'll light that engine for a long period of time, and then hopefully we could speed up the return home before the batteries die, before they can get back into the atmosphere for a safe landing.
Well, speed it up how? Just by propelling forward or by taking a different path?
No, actually, by propelling forward with the lunar module engine. As a matter of fact, we got the instructions, and as we went around the far side, about 2.5 hours after we passed the far side, we lit that lunar module engine a second time, kept it on for 4.5 minutes, pushing us faster and faster back towards zero.
That gives you an acceleration from what to what?
Oh, well, see, the actually, it gives us, we were going around about 6,000 miles an hour. Probably we speeded up our return to about 10. Mm-hmm. But as you know, because after we shut the engine down, the moon is still trying to pull us back, but its gravity is stronger. So we slow down until we cross what we call the sphere of influence, where the Earth's gravity now takes effect, and then we start to speed up again. So we're coming back in. When we got back to the Earth's atmosphere, we're doing about 25,000 miles an hour.
But then there's a crucial thing that's got to be done. You've got to coordinate the navigation. So it's to put yourself on the right course.
That's right. That happened just before we made the burn, before we went around the far side.
Yeah.
One of the big problems was the ground, Mission Control, was worried about our attitude or our guidance system. If our guidance system was not correct, they would not know the proper attitude of the spacecraft so that they could put us in the proper attitude to light the engine to get the proper thrust going home. Now, normally we get the proper attitude by what we call sighting on stars, much like a ship's navigator will sight on stars with a sextant.
Right.
But around our spacecraft, due to the explosion, all these little pieces of mylar...
You had debris blocking all vision.
And they all reflected sunlight, and they all looked like thousands and thousands of stars. We couldn't tell a real star from a false one. And so there was no way we could take sightings on stars. And so the ground came up and said, well, why don't we use the sun? That's the one thing they can see. It's a star, and the guidance system knows that it's a star. And so we use the sun as a, what we call a sun check to make sure that our guidance system was correctly in position.
We'll go to clip 21, which we have here. This, again, from the film, our last clip from the film. And after we hear it, you tell me how accurate this is when it comes to finding the right guidance course.
Okay.
Aquarius, this is Houston.
Houston, Aquarius.
Jim, we've got another course correction for you.
What's up?
Something about another course correction.
We copy, Houston. Be advised, it's going to take Fredo and I a while to power up the computer for the alignment platform. We have to fire the engine.
Negative on that, Jim. Can't spare power for the computer.
We got to do this blind.
Houston, without the computer, what do we use for orientation?
Sid, come on. We got to be able to give these guys something. Without the power, we can't give them a reading. I'm not talking about power. I'm talking about references.
No, there's no references. We have a bunch of debris up there.
Houston, what's the story with this burn?
We're trying to hash something out down here, Aquarius. Stand by.
Well, now look, Houston, all we need to hold attitude is one fixed point in space. Is that not correct?
Yeah, roger that, Jim.
Well, Houston, we've got one. If we can keep the Earth in the window, flying manually, the COAS crosshair is right on its terminator. All I have to know is how long do we need to burn the engine?
The shorter the better.
Roger that, Jim.
Can they fly it manually and still shut it down on time without the computer?
I guess that's the best we can do, Glenn. We're out of time.
In order to enter the atmosphere safely, the crew must aim for a corridor just 2.5 degrees wide. If they're too steep, they'll incinerate in the steadily thickening air. If they're too shallow, they'll ricochet off the atmosphere like a rock skipping off a pond. The reentry corridor is, in fact, so narrow that if this basketball were the Earth and this softball were the Moon and the two were placed 14 feet apart, the crew would have to hit a target no thicker than this piece of paper.
How close... Well, what was that last voice, as a matter of fact?
That last voice was my co-author of the book, who happened to be... Yeah, the movie happened to be one of the, say, so-called experts when the TV people came on.
He plays one of the experts.
He played one. In fact, he wrote that script just about 2 hours before they actually filmed it.
That's Jeffrey Kluger.
That's Jeff Kluger, right.
Up to that point, is the dialogue right off the tapes?
Yes, very much so. We gave the cast the air-to-ground transcripts, and they then... As they went into the movie, they started to use the transcripts almost directly, merely changing them to make sure the audience understood what they were talking about. Now, that burn that they're talking about was the very last burn we used. Everything else was shut down, and we found out that we were going to miss that corridor that Kluger was talking about. And so we had to really do a seat-of-the-pants maneuver by using the Earth and the little gun sight or little crosshair I had in the window, and use the Earth's Terminator, which we call Twilight, of course, here, to make a proper correction to get home.
That's you on the controls.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're the one who had to do it.
Well, actually, what would happen was when we, without an autopilot or anything to help us, I told Fred Hayes, I said, I will keep the Earth in the window from keeping going up and down too much. You take our backup attitude controller. You keep it from going sideways too much. So both of us were on controls. Jack was timing the burn with his wristwatch because the clock wasn't working at all. And that's how we did the last maneuver.
And from there on, it's around the Moon and back to the Earth.
Well, that was that last maneuver was already on the way to the Earth.
Yeah.
So after that, we had to wait until the ground tracked us to see whether we got back into that little 2-degree pie-shaped wedge to get back into the atmosphere of the Earth.
And how do you get into that 2-degree pie-shaped wedge?
Well, originally...
You supposedly were pointed towards it, but...
Yeah, the free return course normally would put us into that wedge, but we were slowly being pushed off that course.
Uh-huh.
Now, had we not been inside that wedge, one of two things would have happened. If we were too shallow, we'd have skipped off like skipping a stone on water, and we're gone. If we were too steep and we were above that 2-degree pie-shaped wedge, we would have hit the atmosphere and decelerated at such a fiery rate that the deceleration would be so great that we'd be a fiery meteor for just a few seconds.
To what degree is that within your power of control as you're approaching the Earth?
Well, it was only because we used the Earth to control ourselves. The ground told us how long to make the burn.
Yeah.
They were tracking us. We then did the attitude maneuver and lit the engine manually.
Back there. So it's the work is done, and you just got to wait for a few hours now to see whether you're going to get through or not.
That's right. After we did the maneuver, then we waited for the ground to track us to see whether we got back into that corridor again. To make us planning. And, of course, Milt, I wouldn't be here tonight if we weren't successful.
There was only one try.
Oh, yes.
You couldn't miss and circle the airport and try again.
Oh, no. And also because we had to do it at our slowest velocity going towards the Earth, which was just at that sphere of influence, which meant that our forward velocity was the smallest. And so we did it at that time.
What really impresses me, apart from the courage and the coolness and the strength, not only of you three guys in the module, but the guys on the ground who had so much work to do and for whom the stakes were so very high. Apart from all of that, what impresses me is the sheer competence of everybody involved.
And you can imagine a lot of those guys, most of them, the average age was under 25 probably. And, you know, we were all kind of young in those days, and yet they had confidence.
Well, you were the old man. You were 30, weren't you?
No, I was 42 on that flight.
I'm sorry, you were 42.
Yeah, I was the old man.
It was 30 years ago, right?
Yeah, 30 years ago. No, it was a great team in those days.
Yeah.
And, you know, they loved the job they were doing. In fact, they were probably paid people to be in the job. It was that great.
The setting down in the ocean with, what is it, the Iwo Jima?
Iwo Jima was our recovery ship.
It's a helicopter platform ship, which was supposed to pick you up after the full successful moon landing mission, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. In fact, it was out on station waiting for us. And, of course, we arrived 2 days early. Fortunately, they got there early.
It must have been an incredible moment to sit down in the water and have the divers fix you and the helicopter guys pick you up and get you onto the ship.
I finally felt relieved when the spacecraft splashed down and bobbed back up again, and there was water on the windows, but the thing didn't sink. And I said, hey, guys, we're really home. I think we made it.
Incredible. We'll pause right here. Take care of some commercials that are waiting. There's one other thing I'd like you to listen to. This is not from the film. It's from a friend of yours, Gene Cernan.
Oh, Gene.
Who, in fact, did on Apollo 17 stand on the moon. And he was here about a year ago, and we talked with him about what it's like to walk on the moon and to look at the Earth. This is a one part of the great adventure that you didn't have.
Yeah, the one part that I was not able to perform, and, you know, I've always sort of had a twinge of envy ever since.
Sure, understandable. Of course, John Glenn went up again. There's no reason why you can't go up again for the next moon landing, if we ever have another moon landing.
I offered to be John's backup. They told me I was too young.
Did they? He's 78, or he was 78 when he went up the last time. We return directly to Jim Lovell, and we'll hear a few contemplative words from Gene Cernan, and then shortly we'll be on to your telephone calls. In fact, we'll open the lines right now. The number, of course, is 591-7200, 591-7200. We return after this.
Now, from Radio 720 WGN Chicago, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milton Rosenberg.
Apollo 13, with a new preface by Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger, is just republished by Houghton Mifflin. It is a commemorative edition, a very handsome edition, in fact, commemorates the 30th anniversary. Tomorrow is the 30th anniversary of the liftoff, And when is the 17th? Is that...
17th is, let me see.
I believe the 17th is the...
Monday, I think, isn't it?
Whatever it is, that's the anniversary of...
Of the landing.
Of the landing.
Yeah, and the 13th, though, is the anniversary of the boom.
Of the explosion.
And Hayes and I call it boom day.
Yeah. As I was telling you, Gene Cernan was here a little bit more than a year ago. And he had done a book, and we had occasion to chat. And here he is talking about what it's like to walk on the moon and to look at the Earth. This is a part of the Apollo experience that you're rather like most.
Mission, there 10 men have landed, and we were the 11th and 12th.
You were the 11th and 12th men to walk upon the moon.
That's right.
And you were the last one to board the ship going back.
The captain protocol says the captain gets out first and in last.
And
that's the way it worked on all of
us. So you were literally the last man on the moon.
To left my footprints. I can remember that moment very well.
How many days were you on the moon?
75 hours.
75 hours.
A little over 3 days.
Yeah. You must forgive the absolute naivete of the following question. This is the way a kid would ask it, but it says, naive and awed as I really feel. What in the world does it feel like that you stand on the moon to be off the Earth and to see the Earth in the sky?
I guess that's a subject of several chapters in my book. It takes a long time. There's not a few words or phrase that can describe it. You to try and put yourself in my place, you know, after this the dynamics of the landing itself, and all of a sudden the dust clears and you shut the engine down, silence reigns. You will never know a more quiet moment in your entire life. And now you're in a valley.
No clatter of urban taxicabs.
No, nothing. And you're looking out at these massive mountains that are surrounding you, and you're in this valley. You realize that you're somewhere where no man has ever been before. You're seeing things that no person has ever seen before.
The whole place is a sea of tranquility, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it really is. It's desolation, but it's been called magnificent desolation. Yeah. That's truly what it was. Bland in color, but overwhelmingly majestic. And then, you know, in a few hours after you get prepared, you get out of that spacecraft, down a ladder, and you step on a surface. And it came to me at that point in time that I'm standing on something for the first time that is not Earth. You can go to the bottoms of the oceans, at the top of the mountains on this planet of ours, and you're still standing on Earth. And I'm standing on another body in our universe and surrounded by this blackest black that you can conceive in your mind, and that's the sky. And I'm not talking about darkness, because I was actually standing in sunlight, but surrounded by blackness, a three-dimensional blackness without end. It was a timelessness and endlessness of space. And the thing that dominated that space were not the stars, because there was too much reflected light off our visors, so we couldn't see stars in that blackness. What was the Earth? Four times the size of a full moon. An Earth magnificent in color, because it was shades of the oceans, the blues of the oceans and the whites of the snow and the cloud. And unlike Earth orbit, where you fly over a river, a peninsula, a city, your hometown, through a magnificent sunrise and sunset, you stand back a quarter million miles away now, and you literally look across oceans and across continents, across from the east coast of North and South America, across the plains and the snow-covered mountains into the deep, dark blues of the Pacific. And
could you make out the actual cartography of Earth?
You could make out the continents, except where they were snow or
cloud covered. Yeah.
But you could literally see from the North Pole to the South Pole. You could watch the sun set on one continent and know it was rising on another, on the other side of the world, all at the same instant, which was more like looking across time than across distance. And you go about your business. We're there to do a job. We had a lot of experiments to lay out. We were lunar explorers. We had geology work to do. We were looking for the unknowns. We were looking for questions we weren't even smart enough yet to think of, much less the answers. And you look over your shoulder, and you had to steal another glance. And you realize North and South America somehow slipped around a corner. And now you're looking at Australia and Asia and Europe. And a few more hours, you're looking at the entire continent of Africa. And it's rotating on an axis that you can't see, but you know must be there. And it doesn't tumble through space. It moves with just precision and purposefulness. And to me, it just came very clear. It was too beautiful to have happened by accident. I was back on God's front porch again.
Was he always that poetic a man?
Gene is very poetic, and But also very accurate. What he said there was quite true. And when he had the time, almost or over 3 days on the surface, he could, especially during his EVAs, he could look up at it. My thoughts when I was around the moon, especially on Apollo 8, was that you could put your thumb up and hide the Earth, which meant that everything you ever knew was behind your thumb. And it made us all feel how insignificant we really all are when everything that you've ever known is can be completely hidden behind your thumb.
The poet E.E. Cummings has a line someplace in his vast body of work which runs this way. There's a great universe out there. Let's go. We began, but in the very new preface to Apollo 13, you and Jeffrey Kluger address the fact that we haven't done much in space. We certainly haven't gone back to the moon since, when was that last, when did Cernan leave the moon?
The last flight was 72.
72. So 28 years ago, we haven't gone near the moon again. We, to be sure, have done one or two Mars landings with instrumentation, but not with human beings. Obviously, we have to go out into the universe. Why are we so slow about it?
Well, there are several factors. One is that for a while there, we sort of waffled back and forth, not really quite knowing what to do. Another thing is we were trying to do something that would get us a quicker return on our investment. That was a space station that will allow us to look back at the Earth and learn more about the Earth itself, which would give us a quicker return to the people alive today rather than our grandchildren, which, you know, maybe going back to the moon, and that that knowledge would give us. And then again, of course, it's time, money, and effort. There are certain priorities of what we can spend our natural resources on or our tax money, and consequently, we have to look and see what the maximum we can get out of our space program that will help us today. And I think we're going the right direction now, but it's taken longer than I expected, too.
Well, something is missing now that did prevail when you were in the Gemini program, and then when you were in the Apollo program, when Cernan landed on the moon and left the moon. And that something is the presence of an international adversary who's also in the same race.
That's exactly right. To have a contender like the old Soviet Union really gave us the spur to really proceed. Mm-hmm. And when they put up Sputnik, and we thought, how could they possibly do that? You know, we thought we were the technically advanced nation. It gave us the willingness to really charge ahead. And without that, without that competition, people can tend to get complacent and we slow down.
What's really going on right now in terms of plans and in terms of the availability of funding?
Well, the major manned operation, of course, is the International Space Station,
yeah.
One which I espouse and one which I thought that was going to be done a long, long time ago. We waffled back and forth in that for some time. Finally, we learned to make it a consortium. There's about 14 or 15 countries working together. And the two primary, of course, are the United States and Russia. But things have slowed down. We have two elements of the space station already in orbit. The third element, which was being built over in Russia and is supposed to be launched by them, has been delayed for months now, and we're quite worried that we might ever get this thing started, or at least it's going to have to be almost an American effort to keep it going. Then, of course, there are the unmanned. We had a very ambitious program to really start to explore Mars unmanned, in anticipation of having a manned flight, trying to get that started, which a lot of people wanted.
And our last attempt sort of came a cropper.
Yeah, two of them did not make it. Of course, you always have to expect failures in our space activities and, you know, things this risky. But the two really set us back quite a bit.
Yeah, but if you had a live person like Jim Lovell on board, you might be able to correct it. But obviously, if it's just a machine, you can't.
That's exactly right. People often ask, why have unmanned things when you can have manned things? But, of course, man was able to change things and solve things on board. And in that particular case, you know, there might have been a good salvation of the landing.
What's happened to you since? The last 30 years, you left the program shortly after Apollo 13.
3 years after. The last flight, 13, was in 70. I left the program in 73. I did work with the guys on the last landing program with the scientists. Then I actually, the last thing I did was to go to Harvard, and I learned enough about business to be dangerous, I guess, but I decided to try my hand at it, and I was in the tugboat business for a while in the Port of Houston.
At Harvard, you did what, an MBA?
No, I got in that advanced management program, which was quite rewarding for me. But I ended up in the telephone industry, first of all in Houston, and then a company here in Chicago by the name of Centel purchased our company, and I came up here to work with Centel and stayed with them and became on their board and was executive VP when I retired from Centel. And then I, you know, on retirement, I thought I ought to do something. And about that time, Jeff Kluger contacted me, and we started writing the book on Apollo 13, which even before the book was finished, we, unbeknownst to us, our agents sold it to the movies, to Ron Howard's group, and they made the movie Apollo 13.
You live in the area here. You always have done.
Right. I when I moved up here, I live in Lake Forest, and I retired there, and I'm still there right now, as a matter of fact.
And, of course, you're in a new enterprise right now. It's a fascinating one.
That's right. My son took a different course from mine. Instead of the space, he got into the cooking business, and he's an executive chef. Been one for about 15 years, graduated from the Kendall School here in Evanston. And about just about a year ago, we opened up a restaurant called Lovell's of Lake Forest in West Lake Forest on Waukegan, and we're doing quite well, and I'm really proud of them.
Is the decor sort of aerospace decor or what?
Just the opposite, on the outside. It's, of course, the architecture corresponds to the Lake Forest atmosphere, but inside we have a captain's quarters down below, and I have a whole wall of space memorabilia there for people to look at, and we have a painting in the over the main bar called Steeds of Apollo that Tom Hanks actually gave us, and that painting was the model for our patch of Apollo 13 years
the
ago.
The three horses,
yeah. That's right.
But it's from a painting that used to be in the St. Regis Hotel in New York, you told me before.
That's right. An artist by the name of Lumen Winter painted it on commission for the St. Regis. It was in there. I saw it when I was at the New York affair just after our flight. Lumen Winter also, we asked him about the same time to do our patch. Then the painting got lost. I guess the St. Regis got refurbished or something like that. It ended up in an auction out in Santa Monica, and Tom Hanks heard about it and knew the background of that particular painting, and very graciously got it for us, and it's now over the bar at Lovell's of Lake Forest.
I guess if you got two guys, and one of whom has played the other in a movie, in a successful and important movie, they sort of have a special bond for the rest of their lives.
Tom and I talk to each other every once in a while. Of course, we're on different courses and a lot different ages, but he is a great fellow. I have to admit that he was like one of my kids. I had him down at our house in Horseshoe Bay for about 4 days. I took him flying. We talked about the program. I took him water skiing. He's a closet astronaut. He always wanted to play the part of an astronaut. And when he heard that Ron Howard had an option to do the story on Apollo 13, he actually lobbied for the job. And he had just gotten the Oscar for that movie, Philadelphia.
You're still doing active flying, are you?
Yes, I still have an airplane. I have it here at Pavlovsky.
What are you flying?
It's a Baron type airplane, and I take it on my speech trips. And we still have a home down in Texas that we go down to occasionally.
You're living the good life.
Well, it's a good life, and it's a busy one, and I'm happy about that.
That's what makes a good life.
Yeah, you never do retire. I belong to two golf clubs. I think I played golf about three times the last 2 years.
Is there much of a fraternity of former astronauts? Are you guys in touch in any significant way?
Yes, there is in a way. We have all gone on to second careers. All the retired people have, because we usually left the NASA program fairly young. I always talk to Borman and Andrews now, of course, on Apollo 8. I still see Fred Hayes. We're going to have a 30th anniversary out in Santa Monica on the 29th, and hopefully a lot of the people are going to be there. Jack Swigert died back in 83, and so he didn't see the fruits of his... it was his suggestion to write the book, as a matter of fact, the day after we landed. He said we ought to put something down on paper.
We are ready for telephone calls. We're opening the lines 591-7200 for a conversation with Jim Lovell, commander of Apollo 13. And that is as well the title of the book, just now republished with a new preface. Apollo 13 by Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger is published by Houghton Mifflin. Our phone number, of course, is 591-7200, 591-7200. All amateur astronauts, all people interested in the space program generally, or in the incredible story of the Apollo 13 catastrophe and pulling victory from the jaws of defeat, the ultimate exemplification of pulling victory from the jaws of defeat. All who are interested are certainly urged to call, but do so quickly. And if you hit the busy signal, then please try again after we say goodnight to some prior caller. At the moment, I see one or two lines still available, and we'll be on to your calls to James Lovell right after these words.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host and moderator, Milt Rosenberg.
And we will go directly to the phones after I tell you that all the lines are taken at the moment, 591-7200. So if you're trying to reach us, you're not getting through, but certainly the proper strategy is to try again after we say goodnight to somebody else. And also, for those who are listening on the Internet at greater distance and who would like to get in on this conversation, you can email us, and we are always interested in receiving emails, and I read a good deal of them on the air. You can email us from any place in the world where you may be located as you're listening to this program. The email address is extension 720, at tribune.com, T-R-I-B-U-N-E, extension 720 at tribune.com, and we'll go to the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Milt and
yes,
Jim.
Sir.
It's a true honor to speak to both of you, and my question is very direct and simple. On the final trajectory, you had a 2-degree window to hit, and from what I can gather, I'm guessing that you were closer to skipping off the atmosphere than burning up, but I'm not sure. I get the impression you weren't right in the heart of that window, but you were closer to the edge.
That's correct. We are actually shallowing out on our return home because we're going out of the free return course. So we had to make that last correction to get back into the middle of that 2-degree corridor to make a safe landing.
Right. I know that there was a lack of communication during reentry, and during the movie it indicated that there was a longer period of time than would have normally been expected, and I'm assuming that that was the case. You were about closer to skipping off than burning up. So actually, the reentry was cooler than normal, but closer to the edge.
Well, the time, what we call the blackout time, was a lot longer than normal, and it was probably due because we were still coming in more of a shallow course at the lower end of that 2-degree corridor than we normally would have been. Of course, Jack Swigert always said, well, we wanted to make it a little bit more, adventuresome.
Were you aware that you were coming in shallow?
No, not at that time. We, of course, by this time we're flying strictly by the seat of our pants. We had no navigation aids, and we were just taking the direction from the ground of trying to make the proper correction.
Right, but wasn't ground control aware of your shallow path?
Well, they were, but that's why we had to make that correction to get back into the quarter.
Right, but what I'm saying is once you're on your final path, even then you were more shallow than ideal. Were they aware of that?
Oh, yes, they were aware of it.
Did they share that with you?
No.
They didn't want you to...
Nothing we could do, so they didn't want to bother us.
Right.
Sounds the right way to handle it. Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. And we go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I appreciate the chance to talk to both of you. Mr. Lovell, I really appreciate your book and enjoyed it. I have one question, or I guess a comment, if you could kind of enlighten us on, I guess, the advantage that it was Apollo 13 that had the problem, not Apollo 8, just because of the backup of the limb.
Well, that's true. There were certain positive parts of this whole thing. One is the fact that we did have a lunar module. On Apollo 8, had this occurred, we'd have no lunar module to get back home again, and it would have, of course, been a disaster.
And devastating for the program.
That's right, especially in that first flight. Actually, the basic cause, which was the wrong thermostat in the heater system of the oxygen tank, had been present on all the flights up through 13, but we were the only ones during a pre-flight test that used the heater system for any length of time.
This had been an oxygen tank that had given trouble before and had received some repair, isn't that right?
Yeah, right. It was dropped out of the factory. It was originally scheduled for Apollo 10. They refurbished it completely, or they thought they did, and then they, of course, raced the chalk marks and put 13 instead of 10 on it, and
and ended up on our spacecraft.
Hmm.
Great. Thank you very much.
We thank you, sir. The number 591-7200, and there are now some lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, do quickly try again. 591-7200 for a conversation with Captain James Lovell. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, good evening. I can't tell you what a thrill it is to speak with both you, and particularly Mr. Lovell. I'm 43 years old and was a huge follower of the space program as a child, and so I was only 12 when Apollo 11 landed on the moon. And now I'm a dad with two sons who are 11 and 7, and we just a week and a half ago went to Houston and visited the Space Center. I got a chance to see the Visitor Center, and as it turns out, two fellows I went to college with now work at NASA. One of them has the job that Gene Kranz had at the time that Apollo 13 was flown, and so we got to meet up with these fellows and get sort of a behind-the-scenes look at the Space Center and actually walked on the floor of Mission Control, and I can't tell you how what a powerful feeling it was to walk in that room and to see the room that we all remember as children, you know, when the cheers went up and you were all safe. It was quite an incredible feeling. I really felt the power of the teamwork and just what a beautiful symbol of exploration that you all embodied with your work.
Well, Kranz was, of course, one of the leaders there that helped us get back, and you probably were in that old control room, which I think is still there.
Yes, we went to both. We went in the old control room actually got to sit at the flight director's desk and just couldn't, it was hard to just comprehend where we were. And then he took us to the floor of the current control room as well. And they were gearing up for a simulation that evening, and we got to see where the space station was on the big projection screen, and quite an experience.
Well, we're glad to hear about it, sir, and thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Our pleasure. 591-7200. We'll take care of another round of commercials. And then right back to your calls, 591-7200, and I shall repeat, if you want to reach us by email, because you're listening on the Internet, we're from rather far away, the email approach is extension720@tribune.com, extension720@tribune.com. Get those emails in if you are so inclined, and we'll read some of them on the air to Jim Lovell, and we'll be right back after this.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milt Rosenberg.
We are talking with James Lovell tonight. Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger are the co-authors of Apollo 13, which is a full account, not merely of Apollo 13, but of a good deal else about your career in naval aviation and your career in earlier programs in Gemini.
That's right, how it led up to the Apollo 13 flight.
Sure. And it's very well written. We've said nothing about your family, though they figure prominently in here. Your wife is a brave and strong woman.
Yes, you know, I call her the, you know, a grounded astronaut. I mean, she was there taking care of four children and keeping her chin up and keeping the family going all during this crisis where you had all kinds of newspaper people, of course, on the lawn. And before the accident, no one was there, you know. So it was entirely changed.
How did the family take it at the peak of the crisis? What do you know about that?
They kept their hopes up. I mean, mm-hmm. They didn't give in at all. They you know, prayed, I'm sure, and helped everything. My son, my oldest son, was away at the St. John's Military Academy up in Wisconsin, and he stayed there during the crisis and watched it from there. And Marilyn, my wife, she kept the other three kids going.
Hmm. We go back to the phones, 591-7200. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. It's a real honor to talk to an American hero, and I read your book and enjoyed it. My question was that when it was getting cold in Apollo 13, because it didn't have any heat, why didn't you just don the spacesuits for the moonwalk?
That's a question that's often asked, and people often wonder why we didn't do that. The spacesuit is a very heavy suit. Had we put those suits on, it would have been very difficult to move around the lunar module with three people. Remember, the lunar module was only designed for two. Also, the spacesuit had a rubberized interior, of course. It's impervious to perspiration going through or any kind of moisture going through, and we couldn't hook them up to have ventilation going. So we decided to tough it out. Actually, the temperature just got down to about 34 degrees Fahrenheit, about the temperature of your refrigerator. But since there wasn't a wind blowing, there was no wind chill, so we hung in there.
Oh, man, that would be cold. How long was it down there?
Well, it worked its way down until we actually landed. As a matter of fact, when we got the spacecraft back on the ship and we went back into it to retrieve some of the equipment in the spacecraft, it was like walking into a refrigerator.
Oh, boy.
And that was for how many hours or how many days?
Well, that was the four-day period. As
the four whole days.
The temperature kept dropping all the time because we were actually radiating more heat out into space than we're gathering from the sun. And the normal way we control the temperature in a spacecraft on a normal mission is to take the excess heat thrown off by the electrical equipment and then balancing it with using radiators.
One of the crew got quite sick, didn't he?
Fred Hayes did, yes. Towards the end, he was had a urinary tract infection and was quite sick.
And you lost, you say, 15 pounds.
Yeah, about 14, yeah.
14 or
mostly
15.
Mostly water, I imagine.
How was your appetite? There's a picture in the book of you and the senior officers on the naval ship that picked you up at dinner that night, I suppose, right after you landed.
Our appetite was pretty good. You
know, I would think so.
All we had was frozen hot dogs on that spacecraft.
Frozen hot dogs.
Yeah, we had to get some of the water out of the command module because, you know, we needed it to drink, but that water up there was starting to freeze, and there was no way we could get it out. And so at the last minute, I sent Jack up into the command module to pour out all the water and the orange juice and the Tang and everything like that to get it back into the lunar module.
Great improvisers, indeed. 591-7200 is the number, and you are next on the air. Good evening.
Mr. Lovell, do you think we'll ever get a manned spaceflight to Mars?
Yes, that question's often asked. We'll get a flight to Mars. When? I'm not too sure. Most of the technical problems are already been solved through sending a manned crew to Mars, with perhaps the exception of what the situation is on radiation and how to protect people from radiation. But right now we're concentrating on Earth orbital type spacecraft like the International Space Station. I'm sure there are people, though, that are working on studies of an eventual Martian flight.
How long would it take to get there?
Well, there's all kinds of scenarios of how to get there. One of the scenarios says take an unmanned supply vehicle first, which should take a long time to get to Mars, maybe a year and a half, but it'll have it orbit Mars. And once it's securely in Martian orbit, and we know about that, then we can send a crew on a rather fast one-way trip to Mars. with a vehicle, hoping that they could then latch up with the supply vessel to get enough fuel and food and everything like that to make a return trip.
Yeah, I also just really enjoyed reading your book.
And how old are you, son?
I'm 12.
Well, you might be the man to go to Mars for all we know.
That's right. Just study hard.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Good night. And you are next. Good evening. You're on the air.
Bill, excellent show. It's an
Thank
honor
you,
to speak
sir.
With you, Captain. Question is, our two quick questions is, how were you recruited to NASA? And number two, I noticed when the chips were down, you had the can-do attitude. How did your basic training in the military from boot camp on of always being, you know, your buddy and you will get you through no matter what, come really into play here? Was it before you got in the military that you carried this through? Were you an Eagle Scout or anything of that nature? Or was it all just from basic training from the DI, from the first get-go, that your buddy and you are what's going to make it happen, and you just applied it?
Well, it's yes to all of the above. I was an Eagle Scout, and certainly my scouting training and experience over the years has really helped me to prepare myself for those flights. I also was very much interested in space and rocketry as a high school kid in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, before there was a NASA. As a matter of fact, I wanted to become a rocket engineer, and I ended up at the Naval Academy and wrote on the development of the liquid fuel rocket engine in my senior year. In 1958, when I was a test pilot for the Navy at the time, and NASA came out saying that they were going to send a man in space, they asked for volunteers, both Air Force and Navy, and I was one of them. And I volunteered for the Mercury program, but I didn't make that, and so I volunteered again for the Gemini program, and got in that way, so I was very much interested in the space program.
You were in the second batch.
Second batch, called the Gemini batch, that's
right.
But my military training, of course, and my experience with the scouting and everything has helped me prepare myself for the flights that I made.
Well, I think the scouts' motto still is, be prepared.
That's right, and it was a very good motto on my part.
It certainly was applicable to your situation. 591-7200, good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening, and pleasure to talk to both of you. Jim, question. I know you were a technical advisor on the film. But didn't you play a cameo role at the end of the film as well?
Right. I was the captain of the Iwo Jima at the last sequences of the film, just a very short non-speaking part, but you did catch me there.
And I keep telling that to people, and they say, no, he was an actor. And I said, no, that was Jim Lovell. That was the Jim Lovell.
How many minutes on camera did you have?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Maybe it was a half a minute or something.
I think it was less than a minute because yeah. You just did a salute and welcome. I thought it was a nice touch for them to do that, to bring you onto the film. To do that.
That was Ron Howard's idea, by the way, and I do appreciate him for that.
But it was a great film, and I think the other thing too is I was going to ask is that you mentioned about your wife, what would she think in terms of if you were offered a flight back into space now, what would her reaction be now?
She'd probably put thumbs down on it, she. she thinks that four flights were enough. As a matter of fact, my wife and daughter were in that film, too, in the crowd scene on the launch. Just briefly, they were there.
In which scene?
And the big crowd scene during the launch when all the people were in the stands.
Oh, yes. Okay.
We thank you, sir.
Thank you much.
It's sort of like the Alfred Hitchcock touch, who always appeared for a few fleeting seconds in any film that he did.
Ron Howard, in this film, had his brother played a very important part, Clint Howard, who is an actor.
Yeah.
Had his mother, who played my mother's part.
Oh, really?
His father played the priest part, and his wife played the nun with the little kid that she was pushing along, and that was his
uh-huh.
young son. So he had the whole family in this movie.
So there were two families then.
Yeah, that's right.
591-7200 is the number, and you are next on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. Excellent program. Enjoying it very much. Have two questions. Number one, when you jettisoned the lunar module, did it go into the atmosphere or did it go out into space? And B, when you landed in the water, was the command module recovered and where is it today?
The lunar module was jettisoned just before we hit the atmosphere and it burned up as it came through the atmosphere and was completely destroyed, of course, by burning up. The command module was recovered. It was sent back to North American Rockwell just briefly for test, and then it was sent out by the Smithsonian, which owns all the artifacts when NASA's finished with them. And it ended up in a museum at Le Bourget, just outside of Paris, for many, many years. You have to remember that 13 was sort of a failure, and NASA, getting its money from Congress, didn't want to have failures lying around. And it wasn't until the movie came out, years later, when all of a sudden NASA and the Smithsonian realized that maybe we ought to have that artifact back, and it's now residing at the Cosmosphere in Hutchinson, Kansas.
Excellent. Excellent program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. And we will go to additional calls. One or two lines are now available. If you've been trying to reach us, try again. 591-7200 is the number. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, I'd like to ask Mr. Lovell. He commented earlier that the people that were at Mission Control were young, but they were very bright and they were the best. And I was wondering if these last few years, with the lack of direction for the space program, if the next president had an ambitious plan, like, say, landing people on Mars, if NASA and the science program would have problems attracting these young, talented people, because it seems more like they'd want to be the next Bill Gates, more so than work for NASA?
Well, actually, there's a mystique about the space program and space activities that always attract young people, but not from a monetary sense. As a matter of fact, I think I commented earlier that they would love to just work in the space program, so there's never a lack of very talented young people to become engineers, flight directors, controllers, astronauts. And keep the space program going. And I hope there is an ambitious program. I hope we do look, definitely and make a positive approach to go to Mars.
Okay, well, thank you.
We thank you, ma'am. A quick stop for a last round of messages, and then we'll be directly back to additional calls. To James Lovell, 591-7200 is the number.
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. Now, here's Milton Rosenberg.
And a few quick words about some program business before we return to the phones. First, I should tell you that tomorrow night, a two-part program. During the first part, live, I talk with Norman Golb, a very good friend and colleague from the University of Chicago. He's one of the great scholars of Jewish history. And he's recently got a book about the Dead Sea Scrolls, which puts a different light on the question of who composed them and what they represent. During the second portion of the program, something we taped only the other day with Michelle Zackheim, author of the book Einstein's Daughter. Einstein had a daughter, and there's a fascinating story that hangs thereupon. And indeed, it illuminates a great deal that is quite surprising about the life of Albert Einstein. Wednesday, we do a program on home improvement with, among others, WGN's own Lou Manfredini, and other fine things to come. We do want to remind you also that our email schedule is regularly available to anybody who asks for it. That is to say, it's an email list once a month of all the programs that we will be doing on Extension 720. And you can get on that list simply by going to our website, that is WGNradio.com. And from there on, it should be fairly easy. Look for the logo that tells you that it will lead you to registering for that web list. 591-7200 is our number. While I'm talking about our website, I might tell you also that if you go to the Extension 720 website, you will find not only a photo gallery with all kinds of important people like my grandson and Margaret Thatcher and Jimmy Carter and Henry Kissinger, but you will find as well an audio archive of many programs that we've done over the years, some of them full two-hour programs, some of them excerpts, and you may enjoy hearing them again or hearing them for the first time. 591-7200 is the number. Here's the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Lovell, you used the descent engine of the LEM several times. Was there any consideration given that you'd use up all the fuel, need to jettison it, and use the ascent engine for further propulsion?
No, there was not. We used the descent engine, that's true, because it had, of course, a lot more fuel than the ascent engine. And we had enough fuel to use it all the way back home and make all the corrections we had to use.
Very good. The Vulcan wish, sir, live long and prosper. Good night.
To descend, it puts down a strong force which slows the descent onto the moon.
And it's a more powerful engine than the ascent engine was, yeah, because it had a lot more mass that it had to take care of. And so, and we used the fuel. There's one thing about that flight that was very, very lucky. Had we had the explosion after we committed ourselves to the moon, just after we left the Earth, we had never had enough electrical power to go around the moon to get home safely. We had never made it. Had the explosion occurred sometime after we left the mothership, the command module, to go down and explore the moon or on the moon or on the way back, and the command module had the problem, we would never have made it back home because we would never have enough fuel in the lunar module to make it home. Mm-hmm. So we were very lucky to have the explosion.
If you had to have an explosion, it came at the right time.
It came at the right time, right.
Yeah. 591-7200, as we quickly go to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. Good evening, Mr. Rosenberg and Mr. Lovell. Yes. It is a pleasure to be speaking with you. My question concerns, Mr. Lovell, about what do you believe future spacecraft designs may be?
Well, that's kind of a hard question. I would suspect that it depends on what the environment's going to be and where they're going to go. We, as far as propulsion goes, we might have things like ion engines or maybe even nuclear engines if they can be for long periods to, you know, say to Mars. We'll have to have a low-thrust, long-period engine to probably get there. Designs might be involved in more habitable quarters, or maybe even producing your own foods if the vehicle's big enough, or at least on space station designs.
Have you seen the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey?
Yes, some time ago, as a matter of fact.
Now, do you remember the Discovery, the ship that took them to Jupiter?
Yeah, well, I remember pictures of it.
Okay. Would that be a conceivable spacecraft to use now?
Well, I think what you're talking about is the artificial gravity that they had of the rotating part. That's been a design that has been pushed around for many, many years. It had to have a long arm to have any, reasonable amount of centrifugal force to interpret or to be the substitute for gravity. But it might be possible, but I don't think that design probably will be available, unless of course you take the nuclear power and put it way from the quarters, the life support quarters.
And my other question concerns the Apollo 13 mission, and in the event
the event of the explosion, were the thrusters at all damaged?
The attitude thrusters at the time of the explosion, some of them were damaged, and that's what gave us the continual rocking back and forth, and where I couldn't stable it or stabilize it, because the autopilot had it on, was in operation to begin with, to keep a certain attitude, and when the explosion occurred and the thrusters were knocked out, a couple of them, the autopilot sent a signal, the computer through the autopilot sent a signal to the thruster, but it didn't fire, therefore we had that yawing back and forth, and we had to take those thrusters finally off and get a different set to control the spacecraft.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you.
Good night.
This book begins, the prologue begins with a tantalizing line. Nobody knows how the stories about the poison pills got started. Most people had heard them. Most people even believed them.
That's true, Milt. In the early days, people said, well, did you carry poison pills? What happens if you had a problem? And we never thought about that, never gave it a thought. And as I also mentioned in a few lines after that, if you really wanted to make a rather quick exit, all you had to do was open up the crank to the cabin vent, and all that oxygen would be gone, and you'd be gone too.
But it's very dramatic. It's like it's from a movie, isn't it?
Yeah.
A spy movie.
Yeah, it sounds like that, doesn't it? It sounds like you carry poison pills in case you get caught or something.
So it was kind of an urban legend that haunted the whole program.
That's right, that we had pills in our medical kit or something like that that would do that.
Back to the phones, and here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. My question is, did you have any communication with the Russian space program during this time? I guess that's the first part of my question. And the second part, are you aware, was there any effect of what happened on the Russian space program, and did they communicate with you about that?
Well, to answer your first question, if you're talking about any communications with the Russian space program during our crisis period of Apollo 13, we didn't ourselves in the spacecraft, but the Russians and 54 other countries offered water recovery assistance no matter where we landed in any of the oceans that we originally were targeted for, the Indian, the Atlantic, and then the Pacific. We had no other idea of their particular problems. Of course, they had problems too, but we couldn't correlate their problems with the problem we had.
Great, thank you.
How did it happen, in fact, with all the trouble, that you still came down more or less at the same point in the ocean where you had originally planned to descend?
Well, as Gene Kranz and his team got together to determine the best course of action to get us home, they determined that this slower trip home, if we could save the electrical power, would put us back in the Pacific, and the task force was already there or going on station now to pick us up. And otherwise, the Atlantic or the Indian Ocean would have to depend on what kind of ship happened to be in that vicinity at the time. They decided to go for the longer trip.
Years ago, Tom Wolfe did a book, you remember it, titled The Right Stuff. It's not about your group, but about the first group. And they made a film out of that, come to think of it.
That's a very good
film.
Yeah.
What is there about the astronauts that sort of binds them together? I don't mean collegially, but I mean, what do they have in common? What kind of men make good astronauts?
Well, I think you have to take a look at the background of the people that started out on the program, and they were all test pilots. They all lived sort of on the edge. They all were very curious people. They all were interested in things like aeronautics and flying, and they were all explorers to a certain degree, all wanted to see what was on the other side of the mountain. And I think that's the type of person that started out in the program.
Hmm. What did you do as a test pilot? And were there some high risks run there, too?
Oh, yeah. I had some problems flying. I did a lot of test work on a plane called the Phantom, the F-4 Phantom. Introduced it into the Navy, the fleet, way back in 1960-61, and did some other work, too. I had engine failures, and managed always to recover nicely. And so this sort of gave the initial people sort of the ability to handle crisis. And I think that the commanders of shuttles these days have the same background experience. A lot of them are still from the test pilot group.
So to make a good astronaut, you need a few life-threatening circumstances as a test pilot before you get into it.
Well, at least the people that are commanding the vehicles. Of course, now in a shuttle program, in the orbiter, you might have seven people. Only two are really pilots. The others are mission specialists, payload specialists, people like that.
Yeah. Let's work in one more quick call, and here it is. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. Listening to how they solve the problems, taking
entry from space reminds me of what Scott Crossfield, he's an X-15 test pilot, stated to me years ago. He said, where else can you find a nonlinear servo mechanism weighing 150 pounds that can be produced completely by unskilled labor?
That's true. The human brain still is probably the most important computer to put into spacecraft.
And, you bet.
And without people on board, a lot of our manned spacecraft, a lot of them wouldn't have been back, starting with John Glenn and having figuring out problems that come up.
I like that formulation, particularly produced by unskilled labor.
Okay, thanks.
We thank you, sir. And we come to just about the end of the available time. Well, you're not quite as young as you used to be, but you're still vigorous and very healthy. For a while, you were the health advisor or the physical fitness advisor to the government itself, weren't you?
Yes, I was the president's consultant on physical fitness and sports, appointed by Johnson, believe it or not, back in 1967, and stayed through President Nixon, President Ford, and 1 year with President Carter. And after 11 years, I thought it was about time to let someone else have that job.
But you're still flying. You have your own plane.
I still fly. And
now you're in the restaurant business of all things.
I'm in the restaurant business up in Lake Forest. That's right.
Lovells of Lake Forest, is the name.
Lovells of Lake Forest.
What's the exact address?
It's 915 South Waukegan. It's right in the West Lake Forest area on Waukegan. And a very fine dining restaurant. And there's space memorabilia. And we've got good food and just good hospitality. My son's doing a great job.
Yeah, we've got to come up there some night soon.
Yes, come with
us. Sounds wonderful. The new book, Apollo, well, it's a redone book. It's reissued with a new preface, Apollo 13, by Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger. And it commemorates, is indeed the commemorative edition for the 30th anniversary of the Apollo 13 mission. Houghton Mifflin are the publishers. It's been a delight seeing you again and having you here. I thank you very much for coming.
No, I appreciate the invitation to come again. It's really a wonderful time here.